Hi there. We're joined in the next edition of our Early Action Task Force work by Paul Cooper from Newham Council. Paul, who I'll ask you to introduce himself in a moment or two, is the Head of Homelessness Prevention and Advice at the Council. And crucially, he's a really important person to be speaking about with regard to our upcoming blog on children and homelessness. And again, just to emphasise, that is part of our Early Action Task Force work, which is funded by the National Lottery Community Fund. Paul, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on this call. We had a little bit of sort of introductions previously, and with all these, you know, we want to be speaking to the right people to make sure we get the right sort of issues and we get an understanding about the issues behind the sort of the subject matter. So I was delighted and actually really, really happy that we got someone in your role on this call. So Paul, over to you for a quick introduction, please.
Good morning, Chi, and thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this. So my name's Paul Cooper. I am the Head of Homelessness Prevention and Advice, as you've mentioned already, for Newham Council. And my responsibility is any person, we talk about households. So any household, be that a single person, be that a family with five children, but any household then who is homeless or threatened with homelessness will come through a part of the service that I'm responsible for. And one of the key things that we have to do, kind of like a major change in legislation that came into effect in April 2018, Homelessness Reduction Act, is that it's our responsibility to be preventing homelessness. So as well as assessing whether somebody is going to have what we call a main housing duty associated to them, actually our responsibility is to help people either stay where they are or to help them access other accommodation so that homelessness can be prevented.
Excellent. That's really useful, actually. And I've got a list of sort of questions to ask and a bit of a discussion, but actually you just jumped to a really crucial part, which is prevention. I've already in my introduction spoken about the fact this is part of our early action work. And early action to us as an organisation, it's about two things. Firstly, it's about stopping an issue from ever occurring in the first place. And secondly, it's from preventing it, that issue, from getting worse. Mm-hmm. So actually, if I were to ask you if your work takes an early action approach, from what you said there, I'd imagine it is very much aligned with early action.
I think it's essential. And I think, and I talk about this, I do lots of kind of training and context setting with other organisations, other agencies, but I would talk about this when I mentioned the Homelessness Reduction Act. And I think as a piece of legislation, the biggest change in legislation in 40 odd years, where there's a duty on the local authority to be preventing homelessness, I don't think you can argue that that is a bad thing. That's a good thing that local authorities should be doing. In a homelessness context, what that really starts to look like is how can we either help people remain where it is that they are? If they're coming to us and they're threatened with homelessness, what can we do to help them remain where they are? Or if we can't do that, how can we help them access other types of accommodation? And then within that, when you're able to then help people access other accommodation, you want to be looking at how that can then be sustained. Because what you don't want to be doing is to create a cycle where people might be homeless, come through to get the support of the local authority. We're able to relieve or prevent that by helping them access somewhere else. And then that pattern repeats again and again. So that's another really important part of what we do. I say that the Homelessness Reduction Act was a really, really good piece of legislation. What I would say is that there were aspects of that where we didn't have as much help as we might have wanted otherwise. And by that, I mean, there wasn't any new supply of accommodation by the Homelessness Reduction Act. There wasn't any change to welfare benefits, which can be a big barrier for people accessing other alternative means of accommodation. But on the whole, I would say that was a very, very good piece of legislation. And it takes us as local authorities much more into that early intervention world, which some of us did beforehand, but it now requires us to do so.
So it's almost like a first step. The legislation is a first step, a first and very meaningful step towards early action. But there's an acknowledgement that actually that needs to be backed up by the right infrastructure and the right services aligning.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Interesting. Now, thank you, Paul. Thank you. Obviously, we talk about the impact of the legislation and the fact that the council are taking that to be focused very much on sort of prevention as well as tackling the issue at hand. But what is the sort of the scale of the issue borough-wide when we talk about homelessness? What are we looking at exactly?
There are a number of factors here, Chief. So if we look, first of all, I would make a distinction between when somebody approaches the council as being homeless or threatened with homelessness, and that distinction between people wanting to access social housing. Now, at the outset, that's a very, very important interpretation to make, because sometimes we find that people who are making homeless approaches are really looking to have social housing as being the outcome. And really, if what we're trying to do is to address homelessness, it's not about preempting what that outcome is going to be. It's about doing that action or those actions that will prevent homelessness. And that might be in the private rented sector. Now, that's important context, because when we look at our housing register, we have over 34,000 households on our housing register. And we get around about 600 void properties that become available each year. Now, this sounds a bit grim, but I find you need to make this real, I think, sometimes for people. So the rate of voids in social housing is very closely aligned to the death rate. I say that sounds grim, but if you think about it, if you are a homeowner or you've got a mortgage, you're likely to move a number of times in your lifetime. Otherwise, there wouldn't be so many estate agents on the high street. You know, if you're a private rented tenant, you're likely to move a number of times. If you're a social housing tenant, you don't tend to move very often. So you don't get those voids in your social housing stock, which means you don't get that churn. So as I say, it's important to contextualize that. So when we then look at how long people might end up waiting before they are successful in bidding for social housing, I look at timescales for people who have been rehoused recently. And a family who might need 3-bedroom accommodation, for instance. We look at recent times, households who have been rehoused with 3 beds, they've waited 13 years is an average time, you know, and so that's a significant time. When we're looking at single people, that's still a 6-year average wait that you're waiting for. So that gives you a little bit of the, yes.
Okay, so 13 years on average, if you're a family of three. Yeah. If you're a single person looking
at a family with a 3-bed need. So bear in mind, depending on the age and the gender of the children, that might be a family with 2 children, that might be a family with 4 children. That will depend.
I see. Yeah. So 13 years. And then if you're a single person, roughly 6 years.
Roughly 6 years.
Okay.
So that's part of the scale of the problem. Newham has the largest, or one of the largest, private rented sectors anywhere in the country. We've got close to 43,000 licensed landlords. We've got over 60,000 private rented properties. So we know that the private rented sector is a housing solution, is a housing option for people. We also know it is our highest reason why people approach us, because they are homeless or threatened with homelessness. So part of the solution, part of the problem. And I think probably not unlike most other London authorities, one of the big issues around the private rented sector is the affordability aspect of that. So while that provides us with a solution, it's about how we can make that an affordable solution for people if we're going to be preventing homelessness. So that's a little bit of the context as well. Yeah.
Useful to know, useful context. And actually, I was struck by the figures there. You know, so you know, 30,000. So the demand is effectively 30,000 a year.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Actually, the supplies, that's 600 a year. That doesn't take a mathematician to work out. There's a massive sort of disparity. You know,
exactly. And
the context is important, isn't it?
And what happens, because we only get those 600, approximately 600 voids will come up. You don't know when a property is going to become available, but approximately 600 properties will come up each year. Because more people join the housing register each year than we are able to rehouse, anybody who joins a housing register, say, for instance, today, that 13-year or 6-year waiting list, that waiting time will depend on the size of the property, but that's likely to get longer, because they join today, they've got 13 years worth of people in front of them, and each of those 13 years will have had more people join than were able to rehouse. So there's a real kind of bottleneck there that then highlights just the scale of the issue. And that's why when the focus of the outcome is on social housing, you've got, I often say this to my staff, okay, which is that we've got a responsibility to be honest and open. We have to present what the reality is, because people's ideal scenarios are very unlikely, actually. So if we present what the options are, people can then make a decision about which aspect they're prepared to compromise on. So we do have options, for instance, that will help people access social housing much quicker.
Okay.
But the compromise there is that very often that's outside of London.
Right.
Now, we're part of a scheme called Home Finder. Yes. So Home Finder will allow you to be registered for social housing in places where demand is less, because demand is less, waiting times are much shorter. So we're rehousing around about one household a week through Home Finder, with an average wait of 5 weeks.
If I may, Paul, if I may interrupt you there. I mean, that's fascinating. I didn't know about that. So but I approach it from the lens of Community Links' work. And I guess we often talk, and we are part of a narrative that says, oh, you know, we believe in the power of communities, and we see it as an issue, as a generally quite a negative issue, to imagine people who've known Newham all their lives, grew up there, who are then having to be sort of moved, if you like, outside of the area they know to new communities. And we talk, and we've done research on the sort of disruption that can cause to individuals and families, particularly young people, of course. And we'll come back to talk about young people in particular. But I'll tell you what, I've enjoyed listening to what you've just said, because to give the Home Finder solution or the process, to explain that in the wider context of what you've just said there, the supply and demand within the borough.
I think that's the point that I make. It's around what aspects you want the people are prepared to compromise on. And I think when people hear that Home Finder option, the instant trigger is, this is about moving me away from my family, from my networks, from people. And it's not. It's about presenting that as a choice, that if that choice is if your priority is around social housing and social housing quicker, the compromise might have to be around your location. And for some households, you know, people maybe who might want to be, you know, fleeing domestic abuse, mm-hmm. for instance, or wanting a fresh start for other reasons, making that move from a community to another may be a very, very positive thing as well. You know, so when you mm-hmm. present those options, that's what I think myself and my team's mm-hmm. partial responsibility is. It's around presenting those options in the best light so people can make the choices from what's available.
And the context specific way you just explained it, you know, it's not good for Daily Mail headlines or tweets or, you know, viral Facebook posts, but it's the reality, isn't it? It's the reality. Might I ask a question? Is there a typical place where a Newham resident might go to? Is there a, you know, via the home finder scheme, is there sort of a go-to? Am I, you know, expecting to bump into someone from Newham in the pub in Fife next time I'm up there for my Christmas? Does it work that way? We mentioned areas of low demand. So effectively, I'm asking you, where is the low demand where someone might find themselves? What sort of places?
So let's just unpick that a little bit. If somebody is on the housing register, they're waiting for social housing. There are, let's put it this way, tricks of the trade, right, which could increase your chances of being successful. Okay. One of which is properties get advertised on choice-based lettings every Monday. And there's a week bidding cycle that goes on. Yes. Mm-hmm. Some people, when those properties first get advertised, they will go in there straight away and will bid on those properties. And they will see that when they put in that bid, they're quite high on shortlists. They might be first, second, you know, in the top 10. So they get that sense, actually, I'm quite close on shortlists.
Okay.
By the time you come round to the end of that week on the Sunday, everybody else has bidded on those properties, and the priority, kind of like how long people have been waiting for on the waiting list, kind of takes much better effect. So people who might be high up on a short list at the beginning of a week are likely to be much lower. So a trick, if you like, is to wait until the end of a bidding cycle and look at those properties where people where less people have bid, because if you've got less people bidding, your chances of being successful are greater. Now those properties that are less popular may well be flats in high-rise blocks. You know, very typically, that would be, there may well be some estates or some areas which people perceive as not wanting to go to. But that, as a guideline, that's a helpful thing to bear in mind, I think.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Now, a really interesting conversation, but I'll be in trouble with colleagues if I don't ask you about the particular impact on children, of course. Now, I've assumed, as a layman, being a layman as I am, I've assumed that whatever impacts sort of families or people in general would have the same impact on children, of course, because families move around together. But I appreciate it's not as simple as that, is it? It's more complex than that. So in your experience, is there a different picture for children? And how does that manifest itself?
Well, I think I kind of take this in two aspects, if that's okay. So I think from a perspective of younger people, now the local authority, all local authorities, local housing authorities, will have a responsibility to 16, 17 year olds who are homeless or threatened with homelessness. Now, this will tend to be work, and this is work that we're doing in Newham, which will be joint assessments between the housing, the homelessness side, so my area of work, and colleagues in children's social care. Okay, because there needs to be an understanding about what has gone wrong in the family home that has left this 16, 17 year old potentially homeless or threatened with homelessness. Yes. So we will do that joint assessment, and that might then mean having a joint meeting with the parents, understanding what's been going wrong there and seeing if there's anything that we can do that can help to support that young person in that home environment. We're also working with other organisations now that might be able to offer a bit of respite, if you like, you know, that kind of like that relationship between the parent and the young person has got to such tension that they just need to have a bit of space and distance to reassess things. Yeah? So we're working with organisations to provide that. But in the first instance, assuming it's safe to do so, that's always our modus operandi, is that, you know, kind of you would never expect somebody to put themselves in a position where they are at risk, or they're putting others at risk. Assuming it's safe to do so, that sense there of trying to help that young person remain where they are. Otherwise, it's then kind of like a sense of whether this is a person that needs to come in and be looked after by the local authority, or whether it is a homeless application in its own way. And there are differences there around kind of like what the local authority has as a duty to be looking after somebody. But if we are saying that a young person is able to look after themselves and live independently, there is a difference. And this is, again, what it comes back to, as I said before, around that sense of having social housing as an outcome and preventing homelessness as being an outcome. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has come to us and they are homeless or threatened with homelessness, what we would then look to do in that instance is to prevent that homelessness by helping them access other private rented accommodation. What we're trying to avoid is that scenario where the young person is going to be spending 6 years in temporary accommodation in a setting which may not be ideal. Let's be honest, kind of like, you know, temporary accommodation will tend to have other vulnerable single people kind of like living very closely to each other, not in a managed environment in the same way as you might have for supported housing. Mm-hmm. Yes. So actually, you know, private rented accommodation may be a route there. Or we'd look at kind of hostel type accommodation, which might be more specialist for younger people, where that support can be provided in that hostel environment over an 18-month, two-year period. Then the key workers in that hostel can be working with that young person to develop the skills that they need to live independently. And then a pathway out from that, which again is likely to be private rented accommodation. Yes, it's around. Now, when you're looking at young people in that context, as single young people, that's what we're looking at. If we're looking at families with children, now we're back to that position that if we accept a homeless duty, those scenarios, people are going to be waiting for long periods of time in temporary accommodation. People being aware of that's likely to happen. And, you know, when I'm talking around about a 13-year average waiting time, if you've got a 13-year-old child, for instance, that 13-year-old child is going to be 26 years old before their success, you know. So it's that harsh reality that people need to understand, because it comes back again to what people's choices are once they understand that's the harsh reality.
Of course. And that does make sense in the context of the family, of course. But if we could just go back one step and talk about the single young person. In the context of the family, we talked about the ratios which make things quite, not unfair, but quite challenging. You know, 30,000 people on the sort of the list, if you like, the register, only 600 voids or free places, free, you know, units of accommodation. That, you know, I don't like those odds. I'm not a gambling man, but I wouldn't like those odds for me and my family. But for a single person, I mean, you're a single young person. You spoke about the sort of support and a more joined up approach. But is the supply and demand, is the gap as big in terms of supply and demand, or is it better?
Well, so you get that disparity between the waiting times for single people and families. And what tends to happen is that you have a larger supply of smaller one-bed properties. That's not quite the case in Newham. I think that will start to happen as more supply and properties get developed. As newer properties get developed, they tend to be kind of like smaller units. It's just the way in which these things are funded, kind of like one beds, two beds, tend to be the larger parts of the stock. So, and you will have, unlike other size properties, you will have a natural churn within one bed properties, because somebody who moves into a one bed property is during the course of their life is going to, you know, may have children, may have partners, and may need to move somewhere bigger. So there is that churn aspects in the single person accommodation. But further down the line, you still need that void in the two beds to allow that to happen. So that's why you've still got a lengthy waiting time, but it's much shorter because there is a bigger supply for one beds. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. It does make sense. I'm hearing that it's all part of the same system, if you like. You know, you can't, you know, separate the experience of young people in homelessness from what would impact a family, because it's all part of the same chain, if you like, of events, albeit on slightly different parts. So that does make sense. Really interesting. And so I gather the council's got a new strategy around homelessness coming out to cover 2021 to 2026. We've seen the draft version of that, the paper that went to consultation. And I believe members of the public were able to feed in and give their, you know, impressions and their views on that. Without asking you to sort of divulge any sort of, you know, anything that hasn't been announced yet, is there anything you could tell us about the strategy when it's released?
I think it was approved last week.
Excellent.
So I think that went to council was approved last week.
Excellent. But, yeah. Any highlights you might be able to?
Well, it's similar to what it is that I've said already. It's taken us. I mean, we haven't had a homelessness and rough sleeping strategy in place properly for about 5 years. We had an interim one that was done a couple of years ago that filled the gap, but actually having something there that is a proper 5-year forward-looking strategy, it's been a time since Newham's had this. Now the key elements there, what we talked about at the beginning, it's around prevention, it's around early intervention. We're looking when we're talking about young single people, it's about how we work with our colleagues in children and young people services to make that pathway from care into independent living as supported and sustainable as possible. There is a large part in there that is around the private rented sector. It's partly around the relationships that we have with our landlords to make sure that there is a good supply of private rented accommodation, that private rented accommodation is well managed, and the standards of that private accommodation is good. We are in a relatively unique position in Newham, in the fact that we have the only licensed pretty much 100% licensed private rented sector. There's just some properties in the Olympic Village which aren't licensed. But other than that, all properties in Newham, private rented sector properties in Newham, need to be licensed, which means they need to be up to a certain standard. It means that the landlord needs to be complying with certain practices. We're due to go back to the Secretary of State. These things have to be approved by the Secretary of State. We're due to go back to the Secretary of State next calendar year, 2022, to get that extended. And we're hopeful that that will be the case, because we see that as being a critical part of managing the stock and the relationships within within Newham. That's a key aspect for us. There's things in there around how we support and recognise people who might be more vulnerable than others. So it's when someone is homeless or threatened with homelessness, they are required to agree what's called a personal housing plan. The personal housing plan sets out in it reasonable steps that the person will undertake to either prevent or relieve their homelessness. The biggest analogy I can make is, if you are looking for work, you go to the job centre, you might have a back to work plan. Yes. And that back to work plan might say you need to work on your CV, for instance. That's not really about getting a job, but that doing that work about the CV might help get a job.
Of course.
And the personal housing plan works in a very, very similar way. So we find, for instance, that one of the biggest barriers to getting into private rented accommodation is affordability. Mm-hmm. Now, part of that is because of the benefit cap that gets applied to people if they're in the private rented sector. I'm going to talk about that a little bit longer if that gives, because very often people forget about the benefit cap and the impact that has.
Exactly, isn't it?
Yeah. But by being in employment for 16 hours or more, you become exempt from the benefit cap. And by being exempt from the benefit cap, you can afford much more. So these things might not on the surface have an obvious connection, but they do have impact in terms of what people's options are. So we will have these personal housing plans, these reasonable steps that people will be expected to undertake. Then we recognise that for some people, that might be harder. That might be more difficult. You can't have a personal housing plan that you just take off the shelf and you apply to everybody. So we're doing work in the homelessness and rough sleeping strategy, but we're starting that now around developing specific pathways for some of those more complex groups, making sure that people understand from the outset what the expectation is going to be on them and what the council can offer. And then putting in place tailored suites of options that might relate specifically to people, ex-offenders who are coming out from prison, people who are fleeing domestic abuse, younger people, for instance, where we'd have a more tailored type of housing option for them.
Interesting. So it's not a one size fits all.
It can't be.
A young person in particular, there will be a tailored pathway to help them deal with whatever challenges there are that will hopefully allow them to be housed in a way that they're not just moved from place to place to place.
Exactly.
But also mindful of what's going to happen in the future as well, like you said, where, you know, when that young person might be in a one bed initially, but they'll have a family, of course, in the future.
Exactly.
Or they might have a partner, or might need to move into. So to me, it sounds like the strategy is very joined up. You know, so it sounds like it's timely and it's joined up.
Let me give you another example, Shay, and that is that's in the personal housing plan, we recognise that some young people may never have lived independently beforehand. Yes, that sense of living by yourself, having to pay bills, having to budget, having to get on with your neighbours who might be living kind of like in close proximity to you. So within now our personal housing plans, We are putting in place reasonable steps, which is around about building that understanding for the young person about what it means to sustain a tenancy. There is a product, I say a product, it's called My Bank. It was very much coming out from care leaver services where people haven't lived independently before and helping them with budget management. It's quite intensive. It's a 5-day course. And it also involves, in that 5 days, it involves going out to a void social housing property and spending a day around there and walking around and looking at where the meters are, kind of like those kind, you know. So it's very, very hands-on. So we put this into now the personal housing plan, where somebody hasn't had a tenancy before in the past, or if they've had a tenancy before in the past as a single person and that has failed for various reasons, we put that in place because that's going to be part of those key building blocks that people are going to need to sustain that tenancy moving forward. So we are now looking kind of like all of these things.
And that's the early action part, isn't it? That's the early action part, because in many ways, supplying someone with accommodation or a house or a flat, you know, a young person, that's obviously important because they have a roof over their head. But that does nothing about preventing your situation getting worse or preventing you from getting evicted from that particular flat because your behaviours aren't quite up to the standard that we expect. There are actually a few things the council have done to take an early action approach here. There's a licensing, which I wasn't aware of, by the way, which sounds, you know, fascinating and very important to make sure the accommodation is up to scratch to begin with. Then it's the next bit, focus on the young person or the individual themselves to make sure that once they're in that accommodation that's up to scratch, they're able to sustain themselves there. So they're not subject to sort of chaotic lives effectively the council supporting them through these personal housing plans to sustain themselves. That's excellent.
Yeah. And the last part of that puzzle then is that when we help people move into that accommodation, we also now have a team of tenancy sustainment officers. So they are the people that, it's a combination really, that the person themselves can go to if there is going to be trouble with maintaining that tenancy. But just as important, it provides that assurance to a landlord that they can, so the landlord then doesn't have to try and navigate their way around the council, because a payment, a rent payment may well have kind of not come through. And that landlord then has to struggle to understand what the council system is to get that. And as soon as that becomes a barrier, your ability to have that relationship with that landlord to offer that accommodation becomes much harder. So by having our tenancy sustainment officers who are also that point of contact there for the landlords, it means that those landlords are more inclined to work with us. So it's a virtuous circle. I'd like to think it's that. You know?
It is. No, it's fascinating. Lots that I didn't know about, truth be told. So one of the things we did, like I mentioned earlier in the conversation, is we deliver housing advice. But typically, although we're focused on early action and that governs everything we do, by the time someone's come to ask for housing advice, it's normally too late because something's happened.
I'm
delighted to hear this. The council's approach as part of this new strategy really is about, you know, moving upstream, if you like, making trying to avoid these problems from occurring. So in many ways, you're sort of taking away our demand for our services, which I think is a good thing, frankly. If the system works up front, then people don't have to come to us. So that's
I think people will always come to services like Community Links. And I think part of my responsibility, our responsibility, let's say, is around the relationship that we have between our colleagues in the voluntary sector, in other departments, and with us as the local housing authority. Because you have to have trust that you can come to us and you can raise a concern and we will respond and address that in the appropriate way and within the appropriate time. And we need to have trust that the messages and the expectations when people are coming to other agencies, that they are set. So people don't come through our door with a level of expectation that we're never going to be able to achieve, and we have to unpick that. Now, we have set up, I say we've set this up. Actually, this is in place for every local authority in the country now. Mm-hmm. The organisations that are able to use this will vary, but in Newham, we say this is open for everybody. Mm-hmm. So there is a standard email that is, as one word, duty to refer, and then it's at newham.gov.uk. But every local authority in the country now has something that is duty to refer at that local authority's name.gov.uk. So if somebody's got a connection to Barking and Dagenham, it would be duty to refer at lbbd.gov.uk. So you no longer have to think about, who was that person who was on that webinar who kind of like that, I needed to send this stuff through? What was the name of the service? Because that would vary from local authority to local authority. See, a single standard way of sending those referrals through for every local authority is a good thing. Because if we're going to prevent homelessness, our best chance of doing that is to have as early notice as possible that somebody is going to be homeless or threatened with homelessness. That's the only way we can do that.
Gosh, thanks.